This is a very fine sangha. Bernhard and Michael, thank you so much for all your efforts and to everyone for bringing this together and making it what it is. We are now coming to the end of this short but sweet retreat. One of the themes to take up is how to move from here back to the world, so to speak. For some time, for many of us, it can be a bumpy road, a bit difficult, a bit of a transition. It doesn't need to be, but our mind can create all kinds of hindrances. Even a good long practice retreat can become a hindrance if we turn it into something, shoulder it, put it on our shoulders proudly, and go back to the unenlightened world. You can see where that goes, huh? Where that leads. Instead of returning to the world, your work, your family, your friends, and so on, ready to teach them, show them, share with them what you have experienced here, you might want to have an ear and a heart open to hear what they have experienced in the last 4 days. While we were sitting here on our butts, they were maybe taking care of us at home, at work. What was their experience? Is it any less or more than yours? The best way to go back to the world is to go back ready and open to learn, humble, humble. Does everyone understand the word humble? To be humble? Uncle?
Demuted.
Humble, yeah.
It's the main.
Usually does that.
These two guys are so humble. That's a good example. But please, for the linguistic reasons.
I was humble because he's sitting in front.
You're always having my back.
Es war demütig, ist ein bisschen schwierig auf Deutsch, deswegen, jemand hat bescheiden gesagt, das passt natürlich auch. Also demütig in einem nicht unterwürfigen Sinne.
Not false humility or false humbleness, pretending to be, oh no, but a genuine humility that comes from being without self. There's nothing more humble than being without self. You are there for the other, as the other. So when you return to the world, if you are truly humble to the extent that you are, the world really becomes your dojo, your place of practice. It doesn't mean you don't have any difficulties or problems, but those difficulties, those very problems become the path, the way through, you see, rather than a hindrance. When something comes up, a difficulty, disagreement, misunderstanding, perhaps anger or resentment or frustration in you. Huh? Well, this is a precious opportunity to see, to see what is lacking. What is lacking? That becomes your dojo, your place of practice, you see? Not something to react against and try to ignore, but rather to open up to it. What does it have to say? What can we humbly learn from this? Then there is no hindrance. Or to put it another way, the hindrances themselves become the way. It's not easy. It takes humility, humbleness, being humble. It takes patience. Everybody understands patience? To be patient. And it requires a kind of determination, not willful, I'm going to force myself. No, something much more basic. As we are in touch with this ground, this groundless ground, there's nothing outside of it. There's nothing that is not connected, no matter how evil or bad or hateful the person or the situation may seem. We share the same ground. There are many expressions like this, Buddhism, Taoism. Heaven, earth, and I share the same root. This is a valuable thing to, again, to realize. In our bones, not just in our head. Birgit, I think it was, in One-on-One, raised the question of a wholesome life, to go back and live a wholesome life. What is that? It's not such a common word anymore. Healthy, wholesome, whole, well-rounded. It doesn't mean that when you go back, you cannot have friends that are not Zen Buddhists. You have to leave your wife or your partner. You can't go out and enjoy yourself. No. It doesn't mean any of that. You can be sitting here in full lotus and be full of delusions. Just because you're sitting in this posture, despite silly statements to the contrary, it doesn't mean anything. You can sit in perfect full lotus and your head can be full of delusions. I see it all the time. When you go back and you can live a wholesome life, all that means is that the practice, as best as we can, continues in our daily life. No, it doesn't mean we have to put our cushion in the living room and disturb the rest of the family, or go off and sit for hours when everyone else is working. We can do our practice in a way that doesn't disturb the others. Huh? Get up earlier in the morning, or maybe sit together with some people. Huh? But it certainly, the practice should not disturb the lifestyle of those around you. There is a time, right now, where we actually come and gather like this. Huh? This is very valuable, and the family, the friends, need to understand. We're coming here as a what, spiritual or religious practice. We're not coming here to play golf or to get drunk and sleep together. This is a spiritual religious practice. And it is important for those that you live with to understand that. They don't have to be Zen Buddhists, but it certainly helps if they can respect what you are doing. And if they don't, you need to look at yourself. So to live a wholesome life simply means, in a natural way, to continue this practice as best as we can in our daily life. I mentioned briefly about noble speech. Well, being mindful of our speech. No, we don't have to be silent all the time. But when we speak, we consider, is what I'm saying of use, of value? Is it true? Is it helpful? Is it beneficial? In traditional Buddhism, they would say, is it in accord with the Dharma? It doesn't mean you can't talk about Jimi Hendrix. But there's a way to speak from out of this. You see? To just jabber away, or to speak ill of others, or to speak well of yourself. These are things we need to be mindful of. In our actions too. I don't think any of you are selling guns to Afghanistan. Many of you are psychotherapists or family members. You know, you have children, grandchildren perhaps. So there's all kinds of roles, responsibilities that we have. Yes, these are wonderful ways of practicing the Dharma without a trace, without a trace. To be there with, for your children, for example. Your grandchildren. If that's not practicing the way, what is? And again, to see for that vast dojo, place of practice, that dojo of the world, to be what it is. And that means sometimes it's a place where we are confronted. We are challenged. We have to see there's a blind spot. There's something I'm not seeing that I need to see. Here the practice really comes to life. Comes to life. Many of you live in the Munchen area, so you have the great good fortune of gathering regularly, weekly, whatever, at a number of different dojos to practice. Wonderful, wonderful. You should sit on your own, but it's also very valuable to sit with others, both for yourself and for the others. This notion of a sangha is quite deep. So when you can, wherever you are, Berlin, there's a number of people from Berlin, to be able to gather together in some way. It doesn't have to be a big formal thing, but in someone's apartment or in a rented room or whatever, and to practice together regularly. No, you don't have to make a big deal out of it, but to practice, to sit together regularly. This can be very, very precious, again, for yourself and for the others. And when we have a chance to do something like this, if you find that this is the path, the way for you, we already have other retreats lined up. believe we have something already set up in the summer in September, and then again already in 2022 we have reserved. So there are opportunities. There's also, the conditions are not quite stable yet, but hopefully soon you can come to Kyoto to practice there. That can be very valuable. I have a little hermitage where people can stay and practice, and then we meet every morning, every evening for one-on-one. And you can really intensely practice, but at the same time, you can walk out of the door and go left for 10 minutes walk, and you're at Kenninji, the first Rinzai monastery in Kyoto, where Dogen trained as a youngster. If you go out of the door and you go right, in 5 minutes you can be at the Kyoto National Museum and see some of the great art and statues. If you go another 5 minutes east, it's actually a Shingon temple, not a Zen temple, but a Shingon temple, esoteric Buddhism. A Shingon temple that houses national treasures of Hasegawa Tohaku, who was not a Zen monk, but deeply influenced by Zen. And his paintings are some of the greatest, not to mention the garden there. So to be able to go out of the Zendo where you're practicing and see real Zen art, architecture, gardens, and so on, you can imagine the value of such a thing. It's not just this little abstract thing we do on our cushion and then we get up, and it's actually still alive and vibrant in the art, the architecture, and so on. So this is I've really come to enjoy taking the people around, come to know also wonderful places to hike. So there are many opportunities to deepen and sustain, nourish your practice. But first and foremost, of course, is your own practice. If you just wait for a retreat, your practice is not mature. If you're waiting for a retreat, or even for the Thursday evening zazen to practice, you're not practicing. It's clear, isn't it? The more you practice, the more it naturally comes from here, not from some words of another, or some book you read, or some person you met. It comes from here. It comes from here. It shows you. Your practice shows you the way you must go. Guidance, meeting with Dharma friends can be very, very valuable, very, very valuable. But each one of us must walk the way for themselves. That's what we have been doing these last 4 days, together. Each one of us walking that path. Let us leave some time now so that anyone that has a remaining question. Also a question now, because we're coming to the end of the retreat. Now is the time to ask. Katerina, you may want to go back to your question, huh? Concerned with going back to the world, everyday life, these kinds of questions. They weren't appropriate 2 days ago because we're in a retreat. But now we are preparing to leave the retreat, if there is such a thing. Huh? So, any questions, something that's not clear, but also questions about the practice in daily life, please feel free to speak up for the benefit of all. You might want to take a minute to stand up and stretch first, okay? Then we can ask a question. Klaus, did you have a question?
Yes, I just would like to add something to the question of yesterday of the ego consciousness. Father Lassalle has written a book about the forms of consciousness. This, and he describes, this book is about 30 or 40 years old. Mm-hmm. I don't remember all of it. But he describes the evolution of the consciousness. Mm-hmm. First, if I know, there is the, mythical consciousness and
magical
and ego consciousness and the and they develop and like each other the upper consciousness contains the first and the transpersonal and integral consciousness and so on. And each person, each child goes in his evolution through this consciousness, for example, the state of mythical or magical consciousness.
Right.
A child thinks that the sun is a person and so on.
Right. And finally, where do you end up?
Just here now.
Yeah, but it's important to see that it's not a state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. All of those states of consciousness are, I think we can all understand them because we've gone through them. Mm-hmm. You know, we've lived, if we remember, when the world is magical. It didn't work by logic, it was magic. The trees were alive, And then we developed rational, reasoning mind. We learned to think, we learned to understand that the breeze in the trees makes it appear like something, but actually it's just the breeze in the trees. And in a way, we lose something. We incorporate it, but in a way, we lose that naivete, you might say. And we gain something else, which is a, for example, rational way of seeing the world. Huh? And then transpersonal, for example, going beyond even that, the individual self or ego. Reasoning, seeing itself and the other. But it's essential to understand in genuine Zen. Zen is not a state of mind. It's not even, in a, to be radical, it's not even interested in states of mind. And you can see why. Huh? Because all of those states, in a sense, there's something being developed, something being gained, also something being lost. But they are states of mind. And as most of you know from reading the Buddha Sutras, Gautama Buddha, when he went through his practice, he entered these very profound dhyana. Dhyana is the word that Zen comes from. Dhyana, that's a kind of deep meditation, dhyana. In those states, he realized, for example, the state of consciousness unbound. There's still awareness, but it's not of anything. It's unbound. Very, very refreshing, as you can imagine. And then he went even deeper. And again, he describes it very accurately, as like space unbound. That's the first of the simplest state. It's like vast space. I trust most of you have some experience of this. You're sitting there and it's as if you're sitting in infinite space. There's nothing in there. It's completely empty and vast. But if you go through then that second state he speaks of, not even that spatial element, space and time itself, dissolves. So he describes it like consciousness itself unbound. But if you continue on through, he then describes it as a state of, well, neither being nor non-being, but literally he calls it nothingness, not a thing, because there's not awareness of the subject, and there's not awareness of anything, even that space, time sense, or a sense of consciousness itself is gone. But there's still something there. And he says, it's like nothing, not a thing. And if you continue on through there, he then describes it again very accurately. If you sit through and see, it's exactly. He calls it neither perception nor non-perception. Maybe easier to understand. Neither sensation nor lack of sensation. In other words, you're not taking in any sense experience. You're there completely, completely open. And yet you're not sucking in anything, nor are you seeking anything, nor is consciousness going out in the eyes, even in thought. So neither perception, perceiving, nor non-perception, because it's not just a zombie, unconscious. It's aware, if I use that word, in a way that is unimaginable. We can't imagine an ordinary consciousness. So he says, neither perception nor non-perception. Difficult, but that's about as accurate as you can. When that bottoms out, when that falls away, that is awakening. And that is not a state. He clearly says, going into those four states, unbound space, consciousness unbound, nothing, neither perception nor non-perceptional. They were states. In a way, the self is dissolved in those states. But the state itself is limited. We come back to ourselves when it's over. Often, the first time you come back, you don't remember because you don't have a place to really register that. It's like, whoa, 15 minutes gone. Where was I? I wasn't asleep. You don't even know what happened. It's just like a blank. But as you get sustained in samadhi, and again, even deeper, these jhanas, you can, for lack of a better word, experience it just as it is. But again, when that itself falls through, when there is not even nothing, how to say it? It all now comes back from the source itself, the undivided source, through all of our senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, sensation itself, and thought, not to mention emotion and will. It now comes back from the source, undivided, and works through all the senses. That's when, as I would describe it, you know for the first time the true beauty and dignity of even these damn the true beauty and dignity of each and everything then shows, manifests itself. That's not consciousness. It's not a state of consciousness. That's why in Zen it's called no mind. No mind, not mind, one mind, big mind. No mind. It is not a state of consciousness, a state of mind. If it is, throw it away. It's clear, isn't it? It's not a state of mind. It's a very important point. Thank you so much for raising it.
Marcela?
Yes. Thank you for your words. Now they were very interesting. I have a question what means full awakened? Mm-hmm. Say somebody who is full awakened, always in the last state, or is
it's
it
not
changing?
A state. There is no state to be in.
Yes.
Then you're fully awakened. When you can let go of all this, what state are you in? Then you're fully awakened.
But Buddha is staying. A Buddha is staying. Our Buddha in the state. I know. How can I say it? I ask sometimes when in the stories we heard, and he awaked fully.
Yes.
Only one sentence.
A full.
What means this?
Anyutara samyak sambodhi in Sanskrit. It means full, literally, something like full and complete awakening.
Yeah.
That's the basis of Buddhism.
Yeah. But what means this?
What does it mean?
In reality.
Yeah, I would say it means being free from the very need to be free. Anything else is still a state. It's still a state. You understand?
Yeah, now I am.
Yeah. The very need to reach somewhere or to get rid of some hindrance is undone. And it's very clear if you read the sutras. He explains. He said, there is no more birth and death for me. There is no more becoming. Disease, dukkha, is itself undone. There is no more for this life. And then it actually said he was considering just sitting there and dying. But, you know, the devas, we can understand this psychologically, of course, but in India, the devas came down and said, oh, no, don't disappear from the world. You have realized full and complete awakening. You must share this with the other suffering beings. And you know what he says? According to the sutras, the Pali Suttas, he says he doesn't want to do that. It would be bothersome. People are so mired in ignorance and self-delusion. It would be bothersome. That's what he said. Read the Pali Suttas. And they have to say three times. They have to beg him to come down from the mountain. And finally, the third time, they use the metaphor of the lotus. You have some, I think, lilies here, but the lotus. They say, but just like the lotus flower, there are those beings who are close to the surface. And if you could just, a little bit, I know you can't do it for them, but if you could just share this knowledge, this experience, that lotus, when it comes out of the muddy, dirty water, it's perfectly pure. It's perfectly pure. And then he decides to, as we say, come down the mountain of his awakening. There are wonderful paintings in Zen of this. Huh? Was he really completely awakened when he got completely awakened? Or did those devas complete his awakening for him? Anyway, this is, again, read the Pali Suttas. It's in there. It's very interesting. The English translation that I read is, it would be bothersome. It was almost a 100-year-old translation. It would be bothersome for me. It would be troublesome. So why bother? These people are so deluded and so ignorant. What I have gone through with great exertion, I have finally realized it, but nah. And the devas have to convince him to come down the mountain. This is a very good koan.
Has he really
something lacking in his full and complete awakening?
Well, if you say this, I think
Well, it doesn't, we don't know about him, but for us, we have to consider this, huh? Mm-hmm. We have to get to where Gautama Buddha got, if we speak of it that way. We have to let it all go. Then what do we do? Then what do we do? That's what this sutta is describing, huh? What is it to come down the mountain of awakening? Huh? Anyway, that's what he did. But yes, this term, anyutara samyak sambodhi, full and complete, unexcelled, it can also be translated, unexcelled, nothing beyond it. There is no deeper, higher way. Unexcelled or full and complete awakening. It simply means there's nothing more to awaken. The delusion is gone. But again, look at Gautama Buddha's own example. It was so thoroughgoing, so full and final, that he was just going to sit there and die. Done, well, how does he put it? Done what needed to be done in this life. There is no more for this life. Boom, I'm out of here. See ya. But then the devas come. Well, we can understand this in various ways. Was it something in himself? He said, wait a minute. Yeah, people can be very ignorant. But there are those that are close to the surface of the water, this muddy water. You know, the lotus can only grow in the dirty, muddy water. But when it comes out, it's flawless, beautiful. So it's the metaphor. That flower is the metaphor of Buddhism. Huh? Consider well what is being said in that sutta. Full and complete awakening. But the devas had to go and teach him something. Had to not teach him, but maybe convince him of something. That he needed to come down. But you see, in this sense, Buddhism is an elite religion. It's elitist. Elite? Everybody, oh, Buddhism, all beings, right? Numberless beings, they're all going to be set free. Bullshit. It's a very elitist religion in the beginning. He was aiming at the people that were right on the surface of the water. It's clear in that sutta. In a way, I suppose that's why Mahayana Buddhism had to develop. It had to develop. It wasn't there in the beginning. He was only convinced to come down the mountain at all because of the people that were close to the surface. You know the story, right? Then what does he do? Who should I share this with? Oh, the five ascetics who I was practicing with, right? But where are they? First, he thinks of his teachers, Alara Kalama. He had two teachers that he finally left. They taught him those states of nothingness and neither perception nor non-perception, but he realized still these were states. So he left them. But he thought, no, they will soon understand. But then the devs, he died 2 days ago, and the other one died yesterday. That's the way they are in the sutras. Don't forget, too late for that. And then he says, oh, how unfortunate. If they had heard, they would have understood. But then he remembers the five ascetics who he had practiced with. So he goes to them, and these become his first monks, in a sense. They're not really monks at that time, but people that practice and awaken under his tutelage, his guidance. Again, this is in the Pali Suttas, you can see. Full, complete awakening. I would say it means there being nothing more to awaken.
What is about the Bodhidharmas? Bodhisattvas?
Bodhisattvas. Very simply, a bodhisattva means an awakening being, a being of awakening. Bodhi is awakening and sattva being. That notion already existed in fairly early Buddhism, but especially in Mahayana Buddhism, this became the kind of standard. So the four vows that we chant, they're also sometimes called the Bodhisattva vows. So here it's very strong, perhaps partly a reaction against what I was talking about, the elitism of early Buddhism. I said, no, this is somehow, this has got to be for all beings. Maybe not even in this life, but maybe in the next life. But anyway, eventually all beings will awaken. But how? How? Those so deeply mired in delusion and, you know, very, very evil, bad people. How can we save them? What can we do? So the Bodhisattva takes a vow to awaken all beings. On the surface, the misunderstanding is they almost get enlightened. They get right to the edge. The door's open and they're ready to go in. And wait a minute. What about all those people suffering? They're still suffering. No. I will not go through that door until all beings can come through. If even one being is still suffering, I will not go through that door. You see what great compassion. This is great compassion. Huh? But it's a silly misunderstanding. You know, he almost got there and then he stopped and waited. No, because he went through, he could see it that way. You know, this idea, he didn't go through. He went through, but he didn't turn it into anything because he immediately turned around and said, now, what can I do for others? This is the Bodhisattva vow. Huh? In a sense, forgetting your own practice and attainment, so to speak, and making that practice the practice of working with others to help others. That's the Bodhisattva ideal. It's not really an ideal. Numberless beings set free. Endless delusion let go. Countless dharma see through, literally master. Peerless way manifest. In a way, this is very far from early Buddhism. But if you dig deep enough, it's there. It's, the roots of it are there. But I wouldn't worry about that now. Would anyone else like to speak up from their experience? Please feel free.
Jeff. Yeah. When you spoke about we enter into some estate and we forget that we're not aware, we think we've fallen asleep. Can you just, I know that it's like, in a way I have to, once you said to Sergio on an online, he was getting right to the bottom and then he was saying visions came, my idea of the bottom, he was really in and then he said he fell asleep and you said you've got to wake yourself up and that's been very with me. There is something that in all the states that are entered into that are good and they become glimpses, it's like, oh, something, but I wasn't asleep. I have to wake myself up. I've been doing it with opening the eyes, just keeping my outer eye open so that my inner eye stays clear.
You have to deepen and sustain the samadhi. As you do that, when you naturally fall into these really deep states, they come within the realm of your vision. It's clear what is happening. For example, neither perception nor non-perception. It's inconceivable, and yet this is it, this is it, now I see. But often what happens is when you first fall into that, there's just a gap. And when you come back to yourself, right? So there's not really anything you can do about it, and it's not really a problem. But I would simply say, continue to deepen and sustain that samadhi, that concentrated oneness, and just let it continue to deepen. And it's not a, you know, it's not a step-by-step procedure. Some people all of a sudden find themselves in a very deep state. Some people, it seems to take forever. They're just on the surface forever. One is not better than the other. If you greedily seek it, it usually doesn't work very well. Simply give yourself to the grunt work, the moment-to-moment practice of deepening that samadhi. Don't greedily seek those states. If they come too soon, well, first of all, you're not even going to really be aware of them, so you can't bring them to life. But also, it can become a kind of a disease in itself, wanting to have this deeper and deeper and deeper. They're all just states. They're just states. And yet, in the suttas, Gautama Buddha clearly explains the value and the limit of each one of those states. Yeah, there's a value. When I go to the dentist now, it's very different. I used to hate going to the dentist. I enjoy going to the dentist now. He wants to give me Novocaine, you know. No, that's okay. Do it. Are you sure? You raise your left hand. That's a good way to test. That's a good way to test. But in all of those states, there is something that emerges. But it's a state. It's a state. For example, I mean, freedom from pain. Neither pain nor pleasure. That's still samadhi. That's not even jhana. Okay? If you're sitting in samadhi deeply, the first thing that arises is a sense of joy. A sense of joy. It's a kind of a release, at least for a moment, from all of the clinging and all of the tensions and everything, right? When you're sitting properly, at least for a moment, it's released. And so naturally, this kind of joy. Well, but it's a joy precisely from not. It's not the joy of having a delicious meal or drinking a beer. It's a joy from precisely not grasping onto anything, at least for a moment. Okay? So that's, if you're practicing properly, very soon that should happen. Often there's also like, real pain in the knee because you're not used to it with the body. But if you're sitting properly, a sense of joy arises because you're not. Those tensions are being released. But that's just the first level. If you go deeper, again, this is still just samadhi, a concentrated oneness. An important distinction. This is the practice of becoming one, because the self is split. Dhyana, you might say, is this the point of being without self. It's temporary, but eventually it becomes the way it is. So there's an important difference. I don't want to overemphasize it, but becoming one is the practice in the beginning, because the self is not one, it's split. So we have the breath, we have concentration, attention, even a koan to help us unify. Huh? That's the process of the divided self becoming one. That's still samadhi. But in the deeper samadhi, already there's the experience of neither pain nor pleasure. Neither pain nor pleasure. And probably most of you have experienced it, at least momentarily, where you're sitting there and there's all kinds of maybe pleasurable or painful sensations, and then all of a sudden, there's neither, it's so subtle. It's so refined that the experience, the sensation of pain or pleasure, dissolved. Well, once you've really experienced that, you know the nature of pain and how it comes to its own end. So going to the dentist is a very different experience. But again, this is still samadhi. This is still the becoming one. If you continue through there, what I would call being without self, these are the dhyana states that I mentioned. Huh? Space unbound, consciousness unbound, nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception. But you don't have to go through all of these states. That's the point. In certain schools of Buddhism, you do. Every time you meditate, you have to go through, you know, you experience joy, then you experience neither sensation, pleasure nor pain. And when you come out of it, you go the other way. You actually consciously do this. It's a kind of a discipline. That's the way they learn, and that's how they teach their disciples. In Zen, we go for the gold. Because the danger of turning all of these endless states, they're very alluring, very tempting. Huh? Each one of those states, there's a great power in it. Huh? There's a release in it. Huh? So it's easy to get stuck in them. So Zen, on the surface, Zen just says, we go to get enlightened. But what it really means is, we don't need to go anywhere at all. We just need to realize where we are. All of those states are right here. All right. So you don't need to go through all of that. But it's valuable, and I'm glad you raised the question, Ursula, because almost all of you at some point will find yourself in them. And so it's important to know, okay, now I know what he's talking about. And that's right. What is the value? What is going on here? What do I see? And what is the limit? Good. Then move on. Don't get stuck in any state. And don't greedily seek it either. You don't need it. It's all right here. We have about 1 or 2 minutes left. Any short questions? Or maybe I should say short answers? Questions and short answers?
Well,
maybe
Hinayana Buddhists, they do not have this bodhisattva idea. They have the arhat idea, so to get out of the samsara. How do Mahayana Buddhists see this?
Well, actually,
do they accept the Hinayana way of the arhat?
Yeah. Well, first of all,
we will never get out of the samsara at all.
Yeah. First of all, Hinayana is not a politically correct word anymore, because it means the little vehicle, rather than the great vehicle. So scholars tend to speak of northern Buddhism and southern Buddhism, geographical. See, southern Buddhism is the Hinayana, or Theravada, but Theravada is literally the teaching of the elders, the Theravada. So it's very vague and quite complicated, the history of Buddhism. Hinayana is a pretty useless word, and Theravada is too vague. But let us just say, the earlier forms of Buddhism did not emphasize the Mahayana ideal so much. Probably that's why eventually Mahayana Buddhism, because it couldn't continue. It would die out. You just have a bunch of individuals who had got enlightened. Maybe they taught someone, maybe not, but eventually it would die out. So the natural tendency, again, simply put, in terms of compassion, the genuine desire to want to save, to help all beings come to this, to release. That is very strong in Mahayana Buddhism. It's not completely absent in Theravada, but for the earlier forms of Buddhism. But there the focus was on, you must get enlightened for yourself. You must get rid of every delusion. Zen doesn't go there, right? You do, but you don't do it 6 today, 7 tomorrow. It's endless. You follow? But in Theravada Buddhism, again, the Indian influence is strong because that's where it began. Very analytical. They break it up into six sensations. And then the experience of that, and then the object of that, and then it goes on and on and on. And in the meditations, they go through that. Why? To become solely enlightened. And Mahayana Buddhism criticizes that. They say this is not the full Buddhist way. It's only an arhat. Originally that meant the direct disciples of the Buddha. But eventually, because of Mahayana Buddhism, it became a negative term. It means someone who's just concerned with their own enlightenment. Something's not right. How can being without self just be concerned with its own enlightenment? But if you look at the writings 100, 150 years ago in Mahayana Buddhism, they were very prejudiced against Theravada Buddhism. For example, Japanese Buddhism spoke of the Theravada as kind of a lesser vehicle because they weren't concerned with the awakening of all. And reading it today, it looks pretty, pretty one-sided. But there is something very great about the Mahayana ideal. As you go through, if you're practicing correctly, you can't do it just for yourself. You can't. It becomes clear. In the beginning, I was in it for myself. I wanted to have the biggest enlightenment, right? But if you're practicing properly, you realize how much ego is involved in that. It's the ego trying to escape from itself. It's not real practice. That's why the first of the four vows is not getting enlightened, right? Endless delusion, let go. It's numberless being set free. That's the foundation. Until you realize that, in a sense, endless delusion, let go, is impossible. So consider well why the first vow is the first one. In a sense, that's where we must begin. We can't begin with myself. It's been wonderful practicing together. Let us continue on.